What's the maximum speed for the Earth to spin before it tears itself apart? Should we be worried about microbes from other planets coming to Earth? And why don't NASA and ESA use standardized space probes to explore the solar system? All this and more in this week's Question Show. It's time for the Question Show. Your questions, my answers. As always, wherever you are across my channel, if a question pops in your brain, just write it down. I'll gather them up and I will answer them here. Now, I want to give you a warning. We were recording this week's live question show, which we do every Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific time here on my channel. And then the power went out about halfway through the show. And I'm sure Chad will include that in the episode. So you'll see that moment and my reaction. So I had to stop the recording then. You know, you could hear the beep of my uninterruptible power supply. And then I picked things up the next morning to answer a whole bunch more of the questions that people had asked. So this is a weird one, but you know, the show must go on. All right. Let's get into the questions. Azad QM2PM. What is the maximum spinning speed for Earth to handle to not tear apart? Any approximate calculations about it? So first, I want to provide some errata for 2 weeks ago's episode. I said that the Earth spins at 1,000 kilometers per hour, and that's wrong. The Earth spins at 1,000 miles per hour. It spins at 1,600 kilometers per hour. So thank you, everybody, who caught that. And it's even as a Canadian trained in, you know, the metric system, I mess those up. And, you know, not in the ways that cause a spacecraft to crash into Mars, but I do sometimes mix up the imperial system and the metric system. So I'll never make that mistake again. I'll just make new mistakes. All right. So the question that you asked was, if we know that the Earth's rotation gives you a boost to trying to get into space, how far can you take that idea? What is the limit to at which point you no longer get a boost to space because the Earth is tearing itself apart under your feet? And there is a number, which I'll give you in a second. But before we get there, I think we can kind of instinctively find our way to that number without actually doing the math. Let me give you sort of an idea of how to approach this, which is consider the orbit of the International Space Station and other satellites that are in orbit around the Earth. Another way to describe the orbit that they're in is that they are falling, right? When you think about orbits, you know, the original thought experiment is like, imagine you took a cannon and you fired it sideways, the cannonball would fly sideways and then it would crash into the Earth. And if you shot the cannonball harder, then the cannon would ball would fly farther and then it would crash into the Earth. And if you shot it fast enough, then the cannon would go into orbit around the Earth. And that speed is about 28,000 kilometers per hour, about 7.5 kilometers per second. So that tells you that if you had stuff that was on the surface of the Earth and the surface of the Earth was turning at 28,000 kilometers per hour, then things would just start to naturally go into orbit around the Earth. That rocks would lift off the surface of the Earth and then they would go into orbit. And so the time it takes for the International Space Station to go around the Earth is about 90 minutes. And it is an altitude of about 500 kilometers. And so if you get farther away from the Earth, the time it takes for something to orbit around the Earth takes longer, but the actual orbital speed is slower. And so the amount of time it takes you to go around the Earth as you get closer to the surface of the Earth goes down. And so if you were right on the surface of the Earth, it would be about 84, 85 minutes. In other words, if the Earth turned once every 85 minutes, then the rocks, the buildings, the people standing on the surface of the Earth at the equator would essentially have gone into orbit, even though they were standing on the surface. And that's how long it takes. So if the Earth was turning, if a day on Earth was about 85 minutes, then the Earth would start to tear itself apart. And we actually see versions of this across the solar system with asteroids. So you have asteroids which are spun up through either gravitational interactions with other asteroids or even the sort of the light pressure from the sun can cause asteroids to start to spin up faster and faster. And asteroids will get to this place where they're spinning so quickly that boulders will start to lift off the surface of the asteroid and drift around, go into orbit around the asteroid. And sometimes they'll make their way up closer to the poles of the asteroid, and then they'll start to drift back down and land again. And then material on the asteroid will kind of shift and push new material down towards the equator, and then that will lift off and you get this redistribution. So we see examples of this, and this can happen with stars, this can happen with planets, anything out there. TD Ward 23. I'm having trouble reconciling your answer to the question about how Earth's microbes might be detrimental to other environments while also hoping for return samples from other worlds. It seems dangerous for us too. So the overall topic that we're talking about here is called planetary protection, and it's a way to think about how we won't infect other worlds in the solar system with our life, but also to try and make sure that when we bring samples from other worlds back to Earth, we don't infect our planet with that life. And both need to be considered. And we spend a lot of time thinking about and sort of being worried about whether or not, you know, if we clean off a Mars rover well enough to stop it from infecting water on Mars or, you know, the European whales. And the reason is just because that is what's relevant, in that we have sent spacecraft to Mars. We have sent spacecraft to the Jupiter system. We've sent spacecraft to Saturn, that we are in the process of sending even more spacecraft to other places, to Titan, around the solar system. And so that is the problem. The pressing problem at hand is to say, yes, you know, we can only clean the spacecraft so well. Some amount of bacteria that's very hardy is going to make it to the surface of Mars, is going to make it to the surface of Europa. And if it does, then there's a chance that life will be able to get its way into the environment. And we know that invasive species on Earth have a way of kind of colonizing an ecosystem. Maybe that is a risk that we should be concerned about when we send our life to Europa. But absolutely, scientists are concerned about the contamination back, that we could bring back Mars life in a sample capsule and it could be released on Earth, and maybe it could be better adapted to certain conditions on Earth and it could outcompete various life forms. Maybe, you know, because conditions on Mars are so harsh that the life there has just been forced to just fight for survival. And when it comes to Earth, it's like a paradise and it just takes off. So these are possibilities. They're not considered that likely by researchers. And that's just because there's a lot more energy that falls on planet Earth, that life on Earth actually is the more competitive one. It's the one that you've got more life cycles going on for all the different kinds of life forms here on the planet compared to Mars, which has a lower energy density that's falling on the surface of Mars. But still, you don't want to take any risks. You don't want to just go, it'll be fine, right? And so we saw an example of what that might look like with the OSIRIS-REx mission. When the sample capsules were brought back from an asteroid, which you're going to assume is inert, right? You know, you're not going to have any life on that asteroid, although maybe you will. Is that the Andromeda strain? I don't know. Then they brought it back in a sealed capsule, and then they took the sealed capsule to a special facility and they put it into a chamber, and then they open it up inside the chamber in such a way that you're not going to get any kind of contamination from that material into the rest of the environment. Now, for the OSIRIS-REx mission, the goal was, you know, these are pristine samples of an asteroid where you've got volatiles and other, you know, elements and chemicals that are in those samples, and you don't want them to be contaminated by Earth gases, right? But that same system is going to be the one that will probably happen. So you can imagine in the future Mars sample return mission, capsule comes in, there's going to be a very special way that the capsule is protecting the samples inside, that there's no way that they can get out into the environment, and they'll be brought back to a special facility, and then they will be kept under a vacuum for the entire time that they're being worked on and studied, so there's no contamination either into the samples or from the samples back out. And another idea that I've heard that I really like is that maybe that's a good use of the International Space Station, that you take these samples, you don't bring them back to the surface of planet Earth, you take them to the International Space Station, and then you have a lab there that the astronauts can examine it and try to, you know, and make sure that they're safe before bringing those samples back down to the surface of Earth. So there's a lot of ideas, and, you know, because it's never come up, right? Nobody's ever said, but what if we actually did get our hands on fresh samples from Mars or Europa? You know, that part of the work hasn't been thought through, but there are people at NASA absolutely who have proposals for this, and there is policies being developed. David Guy 209. Is there any sense in standardizing space probes, if for no other reason than reducing costs with mass production? I'm also wondering about sending fleets of small satellites to each planet, etc. So this question comes up quite a bit, and people think, well, you know, here on Earth, a lot of the most successful products are the ones that are mass produced, that you get economies of scale, and from the economies of scale, then you get cheaper prices, and that allows consumers to get more phones or computers or whatever. Why can't we apply that to spacecraft so that we can produce a whole bunch of the exact same spacecraft chassis and then just put different instrument payloads on top of it and you send it off to different systems that the manufacturer gets really good at building these very common spacecraft chassis, and we could see costs significantly drop for sending interplanetary missions. It's a great idea, but the problem is that the number of missions that are actually being sent is incredibly low. You know, every few years, a mission is sent to another planet. And in those multiple years, technology continues to advance. And so you see new versions of propulsion systems, new electronics, new memory, new instruments. So that's sort of one part of the issue. The other part is that the spacecraft are designed mission first, right? And so the kind of mission that you're going to need that's going to be able to, say, dip into the atmosphere of Venus to be able to collect a sample is going to be very different from the kind of mission that's going to go into orbit around Jupiter, or the kind of mission that's going to be able to deliver a lander to the surface of Europa, or a space telescope, or whatever, right? And so all of these missions are very different. So not only do you get this kind of lag, a couple of years between interplanetary missions, but the kind of mission that is done is so different that you have to say, okay, what are the science goals of this mission? What are the instruments that are going to fulfill those science goals? And then what is the spacecraft that provides the power, the communications, the all of the other, you know, the compute that will make that package of instruments fulfill the science that has been requested by the scientists? And that is a custom job pretty much every time. Now, NASA and other space agencies have toyed around with this idea of building a common spacecraft platform. So back in the 80s and the 90s, there was something called the multi-mission modular spacecraft. And this was this idea where you said, okay, well, let's just settle on a standardized platform where we have a known propulsion system, we have a known computer that can handle data, we got a communication system, and it's just the individual separate instruments on board. And so a bunch of different missions, like the Solar Maximum mission, Landsat 4, Landsat 5, the Upper Atmosphere Research Satellite, the Extreme Ultraviolet Explorer, the TOPEX Poseidon mission, those were all done with the multi-mission modular spacecraft. But that was in the 80s and the 90s, and it hasn't sort of continued on into the 2020s. So, you know, at some point, they kind of went back to saying, okay, maybe the best thing to do, figure out our science goals, figure out the instruments that meet the science goals, figure out the spacecraft platform that provides the services to the instruments to meet the science goals. But there's some new technology that's been coming out. I guess it's been around for a while, but it's the idea of CubeSats. And so they launched a CubeSat, a 6U CubeSat mission to Mars called Mars Cube 1. And that contained two nano satellites, Marco A and Marco B. And that was using a CubeSat platform. And this is something that's been used in low Earth orbit. There's a ton of these CubeSats that are used for a variety of purposes, mostly like scientific projects, things like that. And it's all very standardized. And so NASA wanted to see, can we use that standardized CubeSat platform to go to another planet, to go to Mars? The answer was yes, absolutely. We're great. And so we could see future missions use CubeSats, which would be really exciting because they're relatively inexpensive, they're very small, and so you could see big cost savings if this is done with future missions. Birds adorb. Why is it so hard to go to other star systems? First, I think you need to sort of figure out, like, where did your expectations that going to other star systems was ever going to be easy? And I think that was science fiction, right? Star Trek, Star Wars, They all told you that you just hopped in your spaceship and you fly at light speed, and it's kind of like you're on a ship for a couple of weeks and then you arrive at your destination. And the reality is that the distances between star systems are incredibly vast. The fastest, farthest spacecraft that have ever been sent by human beings, the Voyagers, would take about 50,000 years to get to the nearest star system. And, you know, they're going to be long dead before then, as would any occupants of the Voyagers if they were along for the mission, unless an alien entity brings them back to Earth. But that's how you get V'gers. So that is the problem, that our puny human brains have a really hard time grasping the immense distances between stars. Now, the way you bring those distances into some kind of human lifetime is you go really, really fast. Instead of going at a few kilometers per second, the speed that the Voyagers are going, what if you went 10% the speed of light, 20% the speed of light? Now, we don't know of any way to go faster than the speed of light, which is what's like all science fiction uses. They just say, you know, here is some kind of technology that allows you to go faster than the speed of light. Well, that appears to violate the laws of physics as we understand them. And so we don't know how to go faster than the speed of light. And it's entirely likely that we will never know how to go faster than the speed of light. And like, I know that sucks, but this is the universe that we find ourselves in and we have to deal with it. So is there a way to go fast, you know, so that you can complete a mission within a human lifetime, but still be within the laws of physics as we understand them? And there have been some really interesting ideas, you know, that you could go 10% the speed of light, 20% the speed of light. And so you could complete a mission between here and, say, Proxima Centauri, which is the closest star system to the sun, you know, within 40 years, 20 years, right? If you go 20% the speed of light, you could get there, you know, within a couple of decades, which would be the lifetime of a researcher who is working on that mission, but still not the kind of comfortable mission for a bunch of astronauts who want to just, you know, take a quick trip over to Proxima Centauri. And the kinds of energies involved to send a spacecraft at those high velocities are just beyond our capability, that we understand. We can do the math and say, here's how much antimatter we would need, but we don't know how to make that much antimatter. And we can say, here's how powerful a laser we would need if we wanted to send a laser sail to another star system, but we don't know how to make lasers that are that powerful. And we don't know how to make laser sail material that can handle a laser that's that powerful, and communications of the data back home. Like, there's a million problems. And so right now we exist in a time in history where the leap to other star systems just is incredibly difficult and beyond our current capability. And that won't be the case, that if you come back and, you know, after I've had my robot body and we're 200 years in the future and we're continuing these question shows with, I don't know, episode 40,000, then maybe fast travel between star systems will be just around the corner, or we'll already be attempting it. But unfortunately, we were just born in a time in history where it didn't happen and it wasn't close, that is the future generations get to enjoy that first mission being sent to Alpha Centauri. But we get to see other stuff, right? We get to see rockets landing at their launch pad. We get to see the time when artificial intelligence, you could have a interesting conversation with a block of silicon. So, you know, we don't get to choose which interesting technologies show up in our lifetimes, but everybody will get interesting technology showing up in their lifetimes. Blogs, Fred, what happens to time dilation in an Alcubierre drive? So an Alcubierre drive, this is a theory. Speaking of not being able to travel faster than the speed of light, so one possible way to do this is that you have a warp drive, and sort of the mathematics was developed. This is the Alcubierre drive. And so theoretically, instead of you moving a spacecraft through space at faster than the speed of light, you stretch space. You surround your spacecraft in a bubble that then allows you to compress space in front of you and then extend it behind you. And so you don't move through space, the space-time warps around you to get you to your destination. And so if this technology works and you're able to, use negative energy to be able to make this journey possible, which we don't think that's a thing, and we don't know how that would be possible. But if we did, then you would experience no time dilation, that you would pretty much, and like, you know, you would pretty much flick the switch on your Kubier drive and you would arrive at your destination no matter how far away it was, right? So you're here on Earth, you flick the switch, and now you are trillions of light years away in less than a second. You know, our Star Trek expectations of how faster than light travel would work are not helpful. It wouldn't be that you would be seeing stars passing past you. Like, it would just happen instantaneously. But it needs negative energy. We're not sure that's real. So right now, this is all just in the realm of science fiction with some interesting math. But no time dilation, which would be cool. So you would arrive at your destination and you wouldn't experience any time dilation. If you want to support the work we do at Universe Today, consider joining our Patreon club. Your support lets us have a minimum of ads and no sponsorship messages. Patrons get no ads on universetoday.com for life. Want the extra parts of the live stream that aren't in this edited version? You can sign up for a special patron-only podcast feed and get the overtime segments as well as other special behind-the-scenes episodes, including our monthly patron-only question show. Thanks to everyone who has already subscribed, and welcome to our recent newcomers. Frank Tolstoy, Mark Cassidy, Billy Love, Eric Hall, David Matz, James Levy, Ivan Dimitrov, Chad Estes, and Alexander Reintzich. Join the club at patreon.com/universetoday. Astronomy 66. If the Oort cloud is touching one at Alpha Centauri, would these clouds be exchanging matter orbiting around either star? If so, are some of the most distant comets that we see looping around both stars? There's kind of like two parts to this question here. So, you know, you're asking, are there objects that are looping around both stars? And that probably not, right? You're not going to have this stable configuration where you're going to have comets that are making this, what do you call it? Like an infinity loop around the sun and then around Alpha Centauri and then back. Like, that is not stable when the solar system is moving in one direction and Alpha Centauri is moving in another direction. Like, these two star systems just happen to be close today, but in a few million years, they will be much farther apart. And it can take millions of years for comets to fall out of the Oort cloud and make their way down to the center of the solar system. But material has got to be getting exchanged from star system to star system. You know, we saw two interstellar objects pass through the solar system. There was Oumuamua and then there was Borisov. And if you see two, that's a really interesting number, you know, within a couple of years. That means there's a lot more. And it's believed that at any point, there are probably tens of thousands of interstellar objects passing through the solar system at any time. And so, you know, how do we get those? We got those by close passes with other star systems that either, you know, we stole some of their cometary material, they stole some of our comet material, or two star systems passed close to each other and that kicked a bunch of comets and asteroids out into interstellar trajectories, and then they crossed Gulf of space and reached the sun or other, you know, star systems. And so this is probably happening all of the time. And so this sort of idea of the boundary where one star system ends and another star system begins, and how material is bound up gravitationally to one versus bound up gravitationally to the other, it's all a lot messier than you sort of imagine when you get farther and farther away from the star. So have we exchanged, you know, material with other star systems? Absolutely. And, you know, if we could go out and analyze every single Oort cloud object in the solar system and then all of the objects around Alpha Centauri, we could probably find ones that seem to share a common ancestor. But, you know, that's a lot of work. Thomas Starkey. If we could see the true color images of exoplanets, what would we see? Green gas giants, purple Earths? Partly we know the answer to this, and partly we don't, which is that, you know, when we think about the kinds and variety of planets that we have here in the solar system, we see similarities that Jupiter and Saturn are relatively similar, and Jupiter is a lot more massive than Saturn. Uranus and Neptune are relatively similar. You know, they're this pale blue color. The terrestrial planets are relatively similar. If they're airless worlds like Mercury or the Moon, they look similar. If they are covered in thick clouds of gas, carbon dioxide like Venus, or whether they're, you know, water worlds with clouds and land like Earth, or whether they're airless, but they're covered in oxidized iron, red like Mars. So we should expect to see planets out there that are similar, right, to the kinds of things that we have here in the solar system. But then there are planets that are out there in the universe which are nothing like anything that we have here in the solar system. Think about hot Jupiters, which are thousands of degrees as they orbit very close to their star. They're going to look very strange compared to Jupiter, right, which is very far away from its star. You're going to have mini Neptunes. You're going to have super Earths. And so I don't know whether, you know, like whether you would get those colors, like what would cause a purple planet? What would cause a green planet? But we're going to get really interesting, weird configurations based on the mass of the planet, the composition of the planet, the atmospheric effects of the planet, the rotation speed of the planet, how far away it is from its star, and so on and so forth. And so we should expect, I mean, unfortunately, it's going to be a long time before we have the telescopes capable of actually imaging those other planets. But when we do, I think we should expect to see a really interesting variety of planets. I can't wait. That'd be so great. Infinite Monkey, are Goofy Thumbnails the zeitgeist of science channels? Goofy Thumbnails are the zeitgeist of YouTube channels. Like, YouTube is dog eat dog, where there are thousands of channels that are attempting to compete for a limited number of eyeballs that are on the platform. And the thing that makes the most difference to whether or not a person is going to check out your video is the thumbnail. After that is the title. And then, like, far below that is the quality of the content in your video. And so people have, not surprisingly, settled on trying to experiment and find out the thing that makes the best performing thumbnail that's going to get the most people to watch the video. Now, you have to deliver in your video what is promised on the thumbnail, or even out deliver that someone goes, oh, this is just some stupid spammy channel. And they click on it and they're like, oh, that was a really great video. I'm really glad that I watched that, right? Great. So that's my power going out again. So when I was recording the question show, the power went out. And so we had to cut everything short, and that wasn't enough for a full QA. And so now we continue. So I just want to finish off the last question that I was getting through. The reality is that because it is so competitive, you have to do things that make your channel and your videos stand out. Your channel is not sustainable in the long term if you don't produce high quality content that is accurate, that is entertaining, that services the needs of the audience. But at the same time, if everybody is doing that, then you have to do the kinds of things that will get more attention. And, you know, thousands and thousands of people have run lots of channels, and they see that there are certain common elements, and having human faces on thumbnails tends to make people notice them, that having some kind of unanswered question in the thumbnail that makes a person want to know more encourages people to check out the video. And so, you know, for me, and, you know, I don't make the thumbnails, you know, that's Anton's job. You know, since Anton came on board Universe Today and has been making these new thumbnails for us, the amount of views that we have on our videos is up by a factor of 5, maybe. So we have 5 times as many people watching our QA videos, for example, than what we did before. And so, like, these things do work. And so I don't feel bad, because I know that what we are producing is scientifically accurate. We are doing a service to education and providing people with useful information. And we don't say things that are deliberately misleading. But if I have to have sort of like a stupid looking face on the thumbnail, and we ask a provocative question, but we also provide the answer, I'm okay with that. And that is just the cost of doing business on YouTube. If you don't like that, then by all means, join our Patreon feed and you will get the videos delivered automatically, and you don't have to worry about deciding whether or not to click on which videos and what. But, you know, you are having the YouTube algorithm optimized towards this for you. And the only thing to do is to switch to another method of watching videos. Grayson Baker, How do you feel about electromagnetic mass drivers, especially for manufacturing them on the moon or in space? I think electromagnetic mass drivers, railguns, EM drivers, like there's a bunch of names for this, but the gist is that you use electricity and magnets to accelerate a cargo payload to be able to get it away from a gravitational well. And you know, the amount of velocity that you need to be able to give to some kind of cargo is enormous. And yet, if you are providing it from an external rail, you know, a launcher, then you don't need to have all that propellant on board. I mean, you think about the payload of a rocket, it is just a couple of thousand kilograms, and then it is supported by tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of kilograms of fuel and rocket and all of that kind of stuff. And so this is like a holy grail that people have been chasing for decades. And the problem is that when you run an enormous amount of electricity, when you put a lot of force through your launch system, then it causes damage to the launch system. And so you get kind of one shot at it. If you're going to try to go from 0 to 8 kilometers per second in a relatively short period of time. And so people can sort of use the launch system once, and then it's kind of mangled after that. And so people are trying to figure out ways to make these launch systems work longer and be more reliable here on Earth. And there's like a lot of ideas, and I've done interviews with people about that. Earth is going to be very tricky to do it. You've got to go through the atmosphere and so on. But out in space, then this system seems like it's really the only way, the best way to go. Once we've got enough infrastructure on other worlds, we're going to want to shift almost everything to electromagnetic launch systems. So, you know, let's look at, say, the moon, for example. Now, you could put a launch system, build it out of material that is locally available on the moon. There's titanium, aluminum, iron, all the elements that you're going to require to build out your system. There's plenty of solar power falling on the moon during the lunar day. And so all you'd have to do is just build your system, have cargo ready to go, and then have it launch along this track. You make the track as long as is needed so that you're not doing damage to the track, you're not doing damage to the payload as you're putting it out into space. And it's estimated you would probably need only about 1.7 kilometers per second in velocity to be able to go into low lunar orbit. Now, you only got a few days before you have to catch those payloads and take them off away from the moon, or otherwise they'll eventually decay and crash back down into the moon. And the moon is relatively difficult. Compare that to, say, asteroids. You could launch stuff off of the surface of asteroids where the escape velocity is tens of meters per second. You know, you could almost throw things off of the surface of asteroids. And the other benefit that you get from using electromagnetic launchers on asteroids is that the asteroid is given a kick in the opposite direction. And so while you are firing payloads off of the surface of an asteroid, you could also be changing the trajectory, the orbit of the asteroid. If it's a hazardous asteroid, you could land an EM launcher, something that's fairly small, and have it just start scooping up material from the surface of the asteroid, pushing it off into space. And at the same time, you are changing the trajectory of the asteroid into something that is harmless. And so for the far future, really, we could make all of the asteroids in our neighborhood completely safe by putting one of these launchers on every single one of them. So we're early days today, but I can imagine it being inevitable in the future. Todd Gibson Art. How long will the artificial satellites that we have launched into Earth orbit remain there? Thousands of years? Millions? Billions? It all depends on the altitude that the satellite is flying at. And so for the satellites that are flying at the lowest altitudes, the ones that are, say, maybe 300 kilometers altitude, they're in a lot of the atmosphere, and they're going to last days, maybe weeks at the longest, before the friction, the atmospheric drag pulls them back down into the atmosphere and they're going to burn up. For things that are higher, things like, say, the International Space Station, about 500 kilometers altitude, then you're looking at months or a couple of years before that atmospheric drag pulls them back down. And then you can just go up from there. So if you go to, say, 800 kilometers altitude, then you're looking at years, maybe decades, up to 1,000 kilometers altitude, which, you know, I think OneWeb, there's a couple, some satellite constellations are planning to be at that 1,000 kilometer range. Then you're looking at decades plus. And then there's like another class of satellites that are at a higher altitude, maybe 2,000 kilometers. Some of the navigation systems are higher. And those you're looking at hundreds of years, maybe even thousands of years. But then once you get beyond that, out to, say, geostationary orbit, which is like 35,000 kilometers altitude above the surface of the Earth, there is no air resistance. Those satellites are never going to return to the atmosphere. And so often space agencies, when they're done with a satellite, they'll park it into what's called a graveyard orbit. So they'll move it away from geostationary orbit to a place that is considered safe, isn't going to collide with other satellites, and they could just be there forever. But they're going to last, yeah, millions, you know, probably not billions of years, because eventually enough sort of interactions gravitationally with various things coming by will kick them out of their orbits, and eventually something interesting will happen to them. Probably go into, you know, either eventually crash down to the Earth or go into orbit around the sun. So, you know, when we think about the potential for space junk in the future, it's really important to sort of consider what altitude you're at. If you're satellites are flying at a lower altitude, that's actually safer because they're cleaning themselves up all the time. It's the stuff that's in the 800 to 2000 kilometer range altitude that is the most hazardous, because it's never going to clean up. As the stuff gets dismantled, breaks apart, as there's more fragmentation, then that stuff is going to kind of be permanently there in Earth orbit unless we specifically go and try to clean it up. Anurag Sagar. Why are we so quick to dismiss M-dwarf stars to support life on their planets? What if they develop Goldilocks zones in 100 billion years, but our universe is not old enough for us to observe them yet? We're still at this point in our understanding of exoplanets around various stars, and especially M-dwarf stars, that we don't know the firm answer to whether or not these planets can support life. But what we do know is that M-dwarf stars, the red dwarf stars, experience a very high degree of very powerful flares early on in their history. Red dwarf stars, M-dwarfs, they are fully convective, which means they don't have these separated core radiative zone, convective zone in the way that the sun does. And instead, they are fully convective, which means that all of the material in the star is just fully mixing up all the time. Now, that's great because they will then be able to use all of that fuel in the entire star, and they'll make them last for hundreds of billions, maybe even tens of trillions of years, which would be great if you want to have a really long-lived civilization around one of these stars. But that fully convective nature means that they also have very severe flares early on in their history. Those large flares are already a problem. They're already punching way above their weight class. But if you want to have a planet that's in the habitable zone around a red dwarf star, then it has to be very close to the star. And so you've got very powerful flares hitting planets that are incredibly close to the star. And so the question that we have right now, and we just don't know the answer, is can a planet maintain an atmosphere as when it's getting hit by those flares, when it's in the habitable zone around that star? And, you know, observations are being made with James Webb and other telescopes, and we should have an answer to that question. Or either a planet will be found with a atmosphere in the habitable zone around a red dwarf star, or we will fail to find planets with atmospheres in habitable zones around red dwarf stars. That is an answerable question. We should know the answer in a couple of years, and then we'll know from there. But what you're asking is it could be a really dangerous place early on, but then over the long term, why can't life get set up and go from there? And then you've got 100 billion years or a trillion years or 10 trillion years. And the problem is that you've got this early phase in the evolution of a planet when it is first starting to form, that you've got the chance for volatile materials in the neighborhood, water, carbon dioxide, methane, nitrogen, all of these elements and chemicals that are needed to support life on a planet like Earth. And early on, it's believed that the planet would sort of outgas all of that, that the radiation from the star would kick it away, and then the planet would just be bone dry. And you know, here on Earth, because Earth has a larger gravity well, it's farther from the sun, the radiation is less intense, it was able to either hang on to some of that material, or it was able to pick up more after the fact and add it to its mass. And now we have oceans and atmospheres and all that good stuff on our surface. But maybe that critical period at the beginning of the evolution of a planet around a red dwarf star just doesn't happen. And so the planet forms, it outgasses all its material, the sun is continuing to blast anything that tries to settle down on the surface of that planet. And then by the time all of the ready available material that could have thickened the atmosphere on the planet, provided oceans and so on, that's all been blasted away. And then the sun settles down, but now the system is a desert. And so none of that material can show up. And that's the concern is, you know, can you get stuff coming back to the planet after the star has stopped having its tantrums? But, you know, this is going to be an answered question very soon, and we will find out. All right, those are all the questions that we had this week. Thank you, everyone who asked questions in the YouTube chat and everybody who showed up for the problematic live show when my power went out. So hopefully that won't happen again in the future. We're actually getting a battery backup system installed, so we should have this problem solved forever. But until then, yeah, our power goes out all the time. My power went out twice in one day. All right. So, but we do the show live every Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific time. So if you want to come and join us, there'll be an event here on the channel. We are also coordinating additional shows for people in Europe and people in Asia. So definitely check those events out as well. All right. Now I'm going to talk about a show that I watched that I really like. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Adam Schaefer, Andrew Gross, Barry Lake Roofing, David Gilton, and David Matz, Dennis Alberti, Dustin Cable, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Paul Rohrbach, Spiderswap.io, Stephen Fowler Munley, and Vlad Chiplin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level. And all our patrons, all your support means the universe to us. So there's a show that's been on Netflix that I've been putting off watching, and I finally got around and started watching it, and I'm really enjoying it, and that is Pluto. And the show is about the future Earth, and there are robots integrated with society, and someone is murdering either very prominent robots or people who were associated with the freedom of robots. And there's a detective who's also a robot who is trying to get to the bottom of this mystery. And sort of it's bringing some really interesting ideas about the nature of consciousness and, you know, the rights for artificial intelligence. And the style of the anime is terrific. It's actually made by a team of people who are one of my favorite anime creators. I don't know if you ever watched the anime Monster. It's also on Netflix. And if you haven't seen that, I highly recommend Monster. If you want sort of an anime that is not set in school with a bunch of superpowered teenagers, or One Piece or Naruto or any of those kind of things. Like, it is more of a straight up horror story being told, or I guess a psychological thriller. And Pluto is of the same style, but it is science fiction. And I really am enjoying the show. So if you want something that's a little more visceral and intellectual, I highly recommend Pluto on Netflix. Also, Hellbound just came back for the second season. And that was one of the sort of most surprising shows that I'd watched a couple of years ago. Korean show about people who are given the date and time that they're going to go to hell, and then monsters show up and take them to hell. It's live action. And it's great. It's really good. It makes you really think about sort of society and how we consider morality and things like that. So if you want sort of two shows that I highly recommend, check out, well, I guess I gave you three: Monster, Pluto, and Hellbound. All right, we will see you next week.